Welcome, everybody, to Space Force. I'm your host, Jason Tondro.
I'm Jim.
And I am a slightly sinusy headachey aide. But still good.
We can't even tell the difference, eh?
No.
And we're here for Salvage, the sixth episode of Discovery's current season. But first off, before we do anything, we have to talk about the most important Star Trek news, which is that Wilson Cruz answers Jim's tweets. Now, for those of you that are not aware of this, Jim has been giving me shit for years about how I had this huge crush on the Scarlet Witch. Now, I am never going
to fail play.
Now, you are never going to stop giving me shit for that. So I'm not even going to try to make you. But now, when you give me shit for that, I can give you shit for Wilson Cruz. And I'm not here to argue, because in that white medical suit, like, it works. Like, he works it. I'm not arguing with you, but man. Aide has no idea what we're talking about, but I think there was like a sexiest man alive contest or something, and it was Michael
Jordan.
Yeah, Jordan got nominated, and Jim is like, okay, but have you seen Wilson Cruz? And Wilson Cruz answers and says, dude, that's Michael Jordan. Anyway, so you should bring him on the show as a guest, since you guys are obviously close friends.
Oh, yeah, obviously.
Next week, that's what we're doing.
Manage expectations.
So in this episode of Discovery, this is the Burnham Goes Rogue episode, right? Where Burnham is forced to decide between her first officer duties, because the Discovery is basically on standby because it has instantaneous travel to anywhere in the galaxy. So the Admiral's like, I need you here in case this diplomatic thing goes sour. And of course, Saru is like, sure, yeah, you bet. We're on standby. Burnham, get everybody on standby. Meanwhile, Book's cat shows up, Grudge, with a recorded message. And Book has basically, he's missing for 3 weeks. And Burnham, who is obviously in love with Book, she can't just sit here and not go rescue him. So she gets Giorgio to help her. And they do this Running Man homage, which we'll get to, and which they break Book out of Orion jail, Orion workshop jail, but then she comes back, and with Book, and she gets dressed down by Saru and the Admiral, and ultimately is relieved of her first officer duties. But she makes an ominous gesture where she unclips her comm badge at the end, suggesting that perhaps there's more to it than simply losing her first officer duties. We also get some hints of what's going on with Giorgio. Giorgio's situation has gotten more extreme. Apparently several weeks have passed because the Discovery gets completely refit. And Giorgio's situation, her mental condition, is now known to Burnham, which means since Burnham is always right and Burnham solves everything on the show, we should start to finally see some progress on it. Well, so what did y'all think? Aide, you want to start us off?
You knew it was coming. You knew the Burnham Goes Rogue episode was going to come down. Yeah. And it kind of just did a bit of that. But I mean, at least the only good thing about it is at least there was some kind of comeuppance for her to actually do it, rather than just some shrugging off and going, oh, well, Burnham, don't do it again. There was at least something to do it. But yeah, the episode itself, it was, like you said before, it's a rehash of stuff from The Running Man and even the section of Star Trek Beyond where they were all in that thing. It's very, very similar to that, where they're all kind of gathered around in that. So it's like there's nothing majorly interesting going on. but meh.
Jim, what about you? What'd you think?
I'm going to enact a new rule.
Okay, what's the new rule?
Only for myself?
Yes.
I'm done reviewing and critiquing. I'll talk Star Trek. Like,
yeah, for
obviously,
sure.
I'll bring up stuff, but I'm not going to review these individual episodes because I'm not enjoying myself. When I start looking at it through the critical lens of how does this episode work? What is this episode trying to accomplish? What is this episode trying to say?
Yeah.
When I start looking at it through that lens, I'm just not enjoying Star Trek Discovery this season. Like, I'm having a really tough time. And this episode, it was an episode. It did what it wanted to do.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to sit here and be like, well, this is 6 stars out of 10. Like, I'm not going to have that critical lens through it anymore.
Okay.
Because it's taking away my love of Star Trek.
Yeah. I hear you.
So when it comes to this episode, like, it was an episode. It was a chapter in this book. That's going to be season 3. And I'll review the end of the book once I know all the pieces.
Yeah.
And I think I'll be able to enjoy it more objectively and be able to judge it for what it is and not what I want it to be or what it could be, which I think is the struggle I'm having.
Well, I agree with you, Aide. It was nice to see some consequences for Burnham's decision. I also found it interesting that everybody on the ship seemed to agree that there should be consequences. Like, we'll get to the conversation between Saru and Tilly later, but, you know, Tilly's like, look, you have to bust her. Like, she didn't really give you any choice. She's basically asking for it. But Jim, I also see your point. I think that as I was watching the show, I began to wonder if we're all just reading too much into it. Like, the whole parasite plotline, the time travel solution, all these things that we think we want or that we're talking about, these big meta narratives, I'm not sure Discovery hasn't just turned into a Mission of the Week show. Well, we were looking.
This is what I said, though. I said this is where your RPG roots come in and go, right, you draw the little minutiae out of all of the episodes and you make an adventure based around that. We can do that with this. We go, oh, well, it's obviously Next Generation stuff. We did this with Picard. Oh, it's obviously going to be this. It's always going to be that. They ignore it. It's just, they just do something completely different. And you go, oh, what a wasted opportunity. You could have done it. No, screw it. We're not going to do it. There are obviously some hints to Next Generation in this episode and some other stuff going on. But, yes, all those little kind of things that we would love to see may not actually happen.
Yeah.
So I think the larger issue is modern television isn't written the way I like TV or the way I experience TV. Like, it used to be that when you got an episode, it was a complete story.
Yeah. Yes.
And it was a distinctly different story than the last week, and it's going to be a distinctly different story than the next week. It may have had similar themes or concepts, characters and ideas. But modern day storytelling is no, this segment is just part of a larger story. And I was thinking about, like, Daredevil. I love Daredevil. Season 1, I think, is fantastic TV. But I can only point to you one episode in that whole show that's distinctly different, and that's Nelson versus MODOK, when there was no costumes and it's just two friends fighting each other in the apartment.
Right.
And that episode is distinctly different than anything else in the rest of the, the 10 other episodes. And I like it for that reason, but I don't judge, like, I don't watch an individual episode of Daredevil and then, like, have a week to sit and marinate on it and be like, no, I didn't like this because of X, Y, Z. Why aren't you bring in this other minutia that I love? I'm just done exhausting myself and I'm just going to try to accept it for what it is and not what I want it to be.
But this is the thing. This is the problem with it being the Burnham show is that a lot of the characters, we have to follow Burnham. Whatever she does, it's her show. She's going to do it. The other characters, like we mentioned before, but sometimes don't get name checked, don't get anything else. Now, Star Trek Picard, obviously, it's Picard's show, but those characters were a lot better rounded out than any characters here. We know a lot more about the backgrounds of the Doctor. We know a lot about the background of the two android characters. We actually see those characters doing stuff without the cards actually having to stand in the corner to justify the show being called after him. Whereas with Burnham stuff, it does seem to be, if they're not talking about her or she's not doing something, it's not being shown on screen.
The sole exception to this was Book, right? Like, we had, like, the Burnham Book episode where we learned a lot about Book, and it was kind of a spotlight episode. Whereas in Picard, we kind of had like a separate episode for each of the main characters, right? And then and we learned about each one of them. It was actually, I was thinking about very much like this, like what you guys are talking about, when I came to this realization, because it came near the end of the episode. And if you remember, there's this scene where she's talking to the Admiral, where she's, it's where she gets dressed down by the Admiral. And she says, listen, let me tell you what I believe, Admiral, that we cannot recreate Starfleet until we solve the mystery of the Burn. Okay, Burnham is always right in this show. Burnham is never wrong. And so if she says that, then it must be true. And that means that, and we've decided, she thinks that the Burn had a central location, that it had an origin point. So now we can see kind of where this is going to go. She's going to figure out the Burn's origin point. They're going to go there, and they're going to somehow fix it.
But how can you fix it? It's blown up loads of ships. It's just like, who gives a crap what happened? It's like
pointing
a volcano and going, oh, we know where Vesuvius erupted, so we now can do something about it. So that was 1,400 years ago, whatever. You know, it's like, don't worry about it.
There's something going on. There's something current. In other words, it's not, the Burn is not entirely in the past. Like, if she says, look, we have to solve the mystery of the Burn in order to fix the Federation, that must be true. So there must be some reason why the Federation can't be recreated unless the Burn is fixed. I'm not saying I like any of this, okay? I'm just trying to follow the sequence of events here based on the internal logic of the show.
But again, that would also make some sense if they were showing, like Dilithium was breaking down. If they had some stuff in store and they realized, oh crap, it's actually breaking down. Maybe, okay, well, something's obviously causing this. Now, still, whatever that actual point of impact was that's now caused it, it's still going on. But they're just carrying Dilithium around like no problem at all. So it's not as though it's actually affecting the current stuff.
Right. You're right.
I think the bigger issue is Bonham's not making a metaphysical argument.
Okay.
She's not saying once we solve the Burn, people can then believe in the Federation again, and that's how we're building it. It feels like, no, the Burn's a thing that I can fix.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what's leading me to time travel.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be led to time travel because I don't think it's an appropriate solution to what the problem is.
Yeah, and getting back to the show, you mentioned, we all saw that the Discovery gets a bunch of improvements this episode, and you think this somewhat disproves your time travel theory.
Mm-hmm. So Calypso is still the fullest thing in the Star Trek timeline we have ever seen.
Right.
That is concluded by various interviews. That's concluded by Memory Alpha currently has it. I had to go back and do my research for this episode.
Yeah.
And that Discovery is not a 1031A. It's a 1030.
It's 1031. Exactly. Yeah.
It doesn't have any of the upgrades. It doesn't have any of the – and those massive upgrades that happen. Like, the cells are detached. Those ablative armor from, like, Deep Space Nine Defiant era.
Yeah.
All over on the ship. Like, it looks like a different ship.
Yeah.
That Discovery looked like the same ship. So – the only way I can rationalize it is that by rebooting the timeline, if they do that, then they could not have gone and got the upgrade, so the Discovery somehow miraculously is reset to factory settings.
Yeah.
And that is just unsatisfying for me creatively.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing, obviously we've seen the Sphere put on some kind of Calypso voice. So obviously something's going on. The other thing obviously could be that could be the Terran Universe Discovery that we saw in Calypso. That would at least come some. There at least comes some reason for it, and it's like, and it's another good reason for why they've got this Giorgio stuff going on. Maybe they're going to do that. And the other thing, obviously, I also read somewhere the other day a theory about that we're not even in the current Next Generation universe. We're now in the Kelvin universe now because of the way the uniforms look and the way the Klingons look and all this kind of stuff. So it's like, who knows?
Well, since we're on the ship and all those changes, this leads us into our weekly conversation about the technology of the 22nd century.
It's a little Star Trek podcast when we are going to bitch about technology.
Yeah.
Like, you don't do this in Star Wars. You're like, the blaster works. Like,
look, I got one thing to say about the changes. First, I like the change of ship. I think the ship looks cool. But if I was a writer, if I'm going to detach the nacelles, I want to fly the ship to an asteroid field so the nacelles can dodge asteroids without leaving the ship. Right?
I don't get it.
You know, that's the only explanation I can give for it. Like the ship is now more maneuverable because we have detached nacelles. Does that mean that the ship can like do a flip and the nacelles will just like, you know, like stay in space? I don't know. We see a little bit of this with Bookship, which can completely disassemble and reassemble.
Admittedly, that was awesome.
Yeah.
Like my wife and I were watching the episode and she wasn't digging it. And when that happened, she was like, "Oh my god, that's awesome!"
Okay.
Like, that was the whole episode for her.
It reminded me of Tron.
Yeah, that's right.
when those robots just turned around. Yeah.
And you had a question in our notes. That ship is the ship that rescued the Discovery from the ice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's tiny.
It's not as tiny as it appears. I think it's bigger than it looks. Maybe
it
not.
It does fit inside Discovery shuttle.
Yeah. It's weird, but again,
so we don't know the energy outputs of these new ships.
That's right.
There's so many unknown knowns out there that we're getting tripped up over.
And yeah, sorry. So, unless I'm mistaken, right?
Yeah.
The naming convention for Discovery A is incorrect. Yeah.
Right.
Constitution refit is not the Enterprise A.
Right, but
Constitution A is the Enterprise A.
There's an obvious solution to that question, though. Everybody thinks the Discovery is destroyed and time travel is illegal. So we name it the A on purpose.
Good point. Yes, that's very good point.
Because if we don't name it the A, they're going to be like, well, is this the original Discovery? That's bad. Like, okay, so it's not.
Yeah, okay, that's a good point. Yeah, so I was going to say that, like, the triple nacelle Enterprise D didn't get an extra letter put onto it. So the idea that this is not A, yeah, that makes sense, though. If they are claiming that the original Discovery was destroyed, that would at least give some credence to it. The other thing I was talking about, when before we mentioned Saru's little meeting where they're talking about the Federation, say the Federation, before all this kind of happened.
Yeah.
The other guys are surprised that they've got a spore drive.
Yeah.
They used it literally in the car park last episode. Right next to the ship. No one knows. It just pipped off existence. What was that?
Yeah, they should.
How would no one not pick that up?
Yeah.
I just want to give a shout out to the CGI designers.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel bad for the DS9 people. So in DS9, in the last 10 episodes, they blew up the Defiant. That was gonna be like the big kickoff of the finale, intertextuality, you know, the big mega plot was the Defiant blows up. So they get a new Defiant, and it's a rechristened Sao Paulo, and there was a giant fight on the AOL message boards, of which I am in now. And everyone's saying the registry number needs to have an A. Like that's the in-universe reason for why the Enterprise goes from being the USS Lexington the refit to the Enterprise A is because it was renamed, so it should be there. And fundamentally, they couldn't do it because that A would have cost too much money because they would have had to scrap all of the previous used FX stocks, and they weren't willing to do that. So they never did that. And nowadays, you can just slap on like Imperial Terran Empire graphics on the Helios ship and you're fine. Yeah.
The way that things are made has a huge influence over the story that those things eventually tell. And I find that fascinating. The media becomes the message.
Yeah.
So
go ahead. Hey, yeah.
Okay, off the ship itself. Now again, we don't know what the hell the nacelles do. I don't understand it. They mentioned in the last episode about the Constitution one. Oh, it's got detachable nacelles. Where does the warp core go? Warp core doesn't go in the nacelles, it goes in the fucking center and they come off the nacelle. Anyway, so it doesn't make any difference. Where the warp core position is does not make a difference to what bloody nacelles have got it. Right. Then we get to the situation where we've now got the new communicators badges.
Yeah. Okay. Right.
So now this is a mistake. This is going to be what can we scupper the transporters with today, Governor? because everybody's now got a personal transporter. Everybody's got a built-in tricorder into those as well.
Yeah.
It's just like, what are you doing? You are making it so easy to basically just have every character just go beep, and it's like it's literally the Star Trek equivalent of Doctor Who's sonic screwdriver. Just wave it around a bit. You've got it literally on your person at all times.
Yeah.
You don't even have to wave it. You just tap.
Oh no! You just literally
You just hit the button.
And I don't know why they did it.
So what you're worried about, you're worried about these potential writing traps they've now created for themselves. They've given the characters too many abilities, and now they're going to have to write stories that can't simply be solved by a tricorder badge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And again, you know. Just the logistics of how it works anyway is like, how can you tap a badge and it beam, where does it know where to beam you? How's, you know, at least with a transporter, you set a location, you beam there. How does, you know, you can, the idea you could use it in like a partnership with a transport would make some kind of sense, but the idea Linus is bipping around Discovery, it's like, how do you know where you're going? This makes no sense at all.
So, I just want to say, I'm very surprised that Jim's logo today is not, this isn't the science lab. Jim?
Full stop, the Linus Runnel was for me the best part of the episode. Like, just the fact that like he can't get it to work.
Yeah.
So when we were watching the episode on Thursday night and they start talking about all the new doodads that the comm badge can do, I told my wife, I said, Ada's gonna hate this. I can already hear him just going like pulling his hair out. Like, he's doing so much. For me, I just think they're overly designed. Like, They graphically don't appeal to me. Like, they're now, like, the oval is now tipped oval, like it's lengthwise, and they've got the ranking system on it, and then they do all this other, like, it's visually uninteresting to me. They did explain that the way the transporter works is you program a home base. So you say, okay, my home base, whenever I hit the transporter, is going to be my coordinates. And they didn't say that in the episode. They said it in like they released like StarTrek.com released like how the new tri-com badges work is what they're calling them.
Tri-com, okay.
And I was like, okay, so if I set this to go to my coordinates, and if I'm injured and they need to transport me to the med bay, and someone just hits my badge because it's the most quick and efficient way to do it, I'm fucked. I'm bleeding in my room.
Don't do that.
No, you don't necessarily know where you are. Yeah. But also, the other thing is, they didn't get new uniforms, though, to match the rest of Starfleet. That I find fascinating. That's weird.
But, you know, it's especially weird because we just got finished saying that the reason why the Discovery got an A on it is so that people won't keep asking questions about the ship that's supposedly destroyed. Well, maybe we don't want them asking questions about why you're wearing uniforms that are 1,000 fucking years old.
Yeah.
To be honest, the new uniforms don't look good.
No, that's true.
No, they're not great. I know, exactly.
They look like bellhops.
Yeah, they do. But this is the thing. I've yet to actually figure out exactly what Starfleet, the general personnel, know. Because, let's say, they're completely bewildered by the idea of a spore driver, even they saw it happen. The captain, the admiral last episode was really worried about them being time travelers.
Yeah.
So do people know they come from the past and it's the original Discovery and they just lost the record? No one seems to know anything apart from the admiral. But most of those discussions just seem to be happening around that little ring where they're looking down into the aliens last episode. Just like they weren't taking any kind of care over it.
We did see Starfleet kind of being Starfleet this episode. Everyone gets sent up on various missions. We met the USS Le Guin. Jim, thoughts on the Le Guin?
I'm so happy.
Yeah.
I'm a giant Wizard of Oz Sea fan. Like, I met, like, it's a personal relationship. I read those books.
Well, you are a friend. We've established this. So.
Yeah, long before I touched Tolkien, before I was even interested in fantasy at all, and I thought fantasy was just kind of weird. And those were the books that, like, taught me what fantasy meant.
Mercy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I just absolutely love Le Guin, whole commentary on feminism, like, radicalized me in that when I was in Starling College. So it was just like, she's always sort of been like this constant pulse and like sort of at my side, like, pointing me to things and exploring new areas. So now that there's a stall ship and it's in my favorite franchise, and there's a captain who kind of looks like Ursula K. Le Guin,
yeah,
the captain of that ship. For me, that was my happy moment in this episode.
Yeah, casting an elderly white woman as the captain of the Le Guin was pretty great. Did you have any thoughts about any of the sort of Starfleet being Starfleet stuff?
Again, it's technical stuff.
Yeah.
A lot of that passed by. One weird was the alien race we got to saw is very, very similar in design to an alien race we see actually on Discovery, which I thought was interesting. But I think the actual coloration is different. I think they're blue on the Federation ship, Federation, but actually in Discovery. But the idea that they are, as I've said, I would have loved to have seen a montage of Discovery's last 3 months where they did stuff. You'll see them delivering stuff. But the idea, very first episode, they were saying 90% of subspace was wiped out. How are they getting communications from all these different planets? How are they knowing that they're going to need someone to bip over to the meeting so many light years away that a ship can't get to when subspace is apparently down? Is it just happened to be we're in the only 10% that it's actually functioning? Again, that one hasn't also been mentioned. It seems to be the idea that they've remembered the dilithium part and the warp drive part, but they forgot about the actual communications problem, which, again, I think is more fundamentally more important, because the idea that you can say, right, we desperately need something. If you haven't got subspace, by the time you've got there, you've probably missed it, whatever's happened. By the time the message even got to you, you've probably missed the event. So I don't know. But, yeah, it's nice to see him actually doing something. It would be, again, we've actually broke the five-limit rule now for NPCs in this group. So this is really cool. We have at least five of those characters that are actually around in Starfleet. And then the actual prison only gets, like, two or three talking parts, but there are many, many more in the background. So that's pretty cool.
Let's talk about the mission. So Burnham goes off on her rogue mission with Giorgio to this remote planet, which is apparently in Orion's salvage yard. And what did you guys think? Jim?
This is when Discovery is about characters and characters interaction, whether it's Michael Bolam and Giorgio going to the mission or them interacting during the mission, or even the stuff, with Bolam and Book when they pull aside and to underscore that there was romantic tension, they play the old Klingon notes from Ash Tyler's theme.
Oh.
Like there's some musical, those like I have the soundtrack, so I've heard them thousands of times at this point.
Yeah.
So they play some of the old musical notes from when the romantic music would cue up. But by the time they make out and they kiss in the turbo lift, that's completely gone. Like Ash Tyler's an afterthought.
He's
no longer in the musical score. So when Discovery does that, I'm super excited. When Discovery decides they're going to borrow a plot point and elements from other franchises or other films or genres, I'm less interested because they're not doing anything new with it.
Do you want to unpack the Running Man stuff for us?
So the Running Man is a movie that came out in 1987, I believe, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger, based on a novel written by Stephen King under a pseudonym. Right. It's one of those movies that's trashy and it is amazing. And it was set in the fall future of 2017. And we all watch TV and we have food riots, there's food scarcity. The human population is not quite in the apocalypse, but we're controlled by a police state, of which Arnold is a member of it in the first 3 minutes.
Yeah.
And then the next 6 minutes, he's a prisoner. And what they have to deal with is they all have these collars around their necks.
Yeah.
And they cross over this invisible full screen that's produced by pylons, visible pylons, their head explodes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And of course, Arnold gets out of it in like 6 minutes. So by minute nine, he's out back in the real world, running around talking politics with some old hippie guys.
Okay.
That's what this episode is. It's just the Running Man, except it's not 6 minutes. It's 6 minutes of the Running Man that's stretched out for 45 minutes of the episode. And your Star Trek, you could this is the thing I had a problem with the second episode, when they're like, let's borrow from the Western theme. Like, let's have bat swinging doors and we'll put dust down and we'll give the guys spoons.
Yeah.
It fundamentally wasn't doing anything with the Western genre that hadn't been done before. It was just referencing it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now, what would have happened if they crossed the screen and we all expected to hit the balls, and instead they got stuck in, like, say, a transporter beam and turned inside out like Stan did in, like, the motion picture?
Right.
And it's so horrific, you can't show the audience that, and the audience has to use their imagination like we had to do for the motion picture.
So suddenly,
even fundamentally, the idea they cross the thing and it just transports them into a cell, that would at least use Star Trek technology in a good way to actually go, oh, they've got, you know, they you can't escape because as soon as you cross the beam, you're back where you started from.
Yeah,
but it's a head explode. I'm like, that's for me, that was just anticlimactic because I was just thinking, okay, what can you do that's so horrific that no one's going to want to risk crossing this thing? And it's just like, I've seen that in a 1987 movie with the same setup. It's like industrial yard and just moving heavy machinery, and it's, you know, nondescript label, which this episode is.
We even saw it. I mean, other movies have done this too. It's kind of a running gag at this point, right? Like Suicide Squad had the exploding heads, and it's just a thing. It's a cliche. It's a cliche.
Yeah.
And it was lazy, a little bit lazy writing. Yeah. Other thoughts on the mission, Abe?
This always bugs me. It's the idea that you have apparently staff officers are willing to just risk everything for love of their life for the episode. It's just like, always bugs me. It's the same I've said before. The idea we always get, like the ensign that decides to ditch everyone on the Enterprise because she falls in love with Khan. It's like, So this is that kind of thing. Now, the idea they've almost tried to justify it by going, oh, by the way, there's a black box there from a ship. I've got two others, but I've not mentioned them yet. We're six episodes in. They're now there. We've got those. And so to try and give it some emphasis to actually say, oh, well, you've done a good job, Burnham, or you've got some information for us, clap, 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 rather than going, you were bloody stupid. Why did you go in the first place?
How about all the junk trade, tech trading, and all the whole salvage?
Yeah, and I don't know what's going on with that either. I don't know what they are doing with it. We are now, we're 900 years after Discovery, we're 300 or 400 years after Next Generation. What is anyone doing with this stuff? Why would a tricorder from 2300s make it be useful to someone that can create nanotechnology beds that just appear out of nowhere? I don't understand what is the point of it.
We saw this in the Western episode that Jim already mentioned, right? When Tilly's like, we need this stuff. Oh my God, what you're doing is so miraculous. He's like, this is programmable matter. Like a baby could do this, right?
Yeah.
Like, why does anybody care about a bunch of ruined salvage from ships over 200 years old, right?
And this is the problem I feel with modern day fiction is we, the audience, care. The audience love the fact that we get to see a boomerang style false contact phaser being thrown around like it's a little prop, because it was always a little stinky prop. We care because they reference stealth stealing stem bolts, and we're like, we've seen that episode of Deep Space Nine. We know about the fun hijinks you can have with Yamek sauce and stem bolts.
Yeah.
But why the characters are made to care about any of this stuff, and why JoJo is so up to date on technology that she can just look at it and say, oh, please, none of the original parts are here. Like, that's still 200 years removed from whole timeline.
Yeah.
Now, there is something about that, because I was thinking exactly those that.
Okay.
Now, Cronenberg in the last episode.
Yeah.
Now, the idea that Cronenberg in the last episode may be Section 31.
Yeah.
In the future version of Six Way, maybe they've done some kind of big info dump to her. So, like a thing. So that's why she knows stuff now, and why she's kind of zoning out all the while. And maybe, I don't know, but there's got to be something there to justify Cronenberg's existence, and something to justify Giorgio's behavior that may at least explain why she now knows stuff that she doesn't know. Doesn't explain the holograms from last episode. That was bullshit. But this episode, it might actually explain something.
I don't know. I'm half convinced that they just got Cronenberg because Mandalorian had Werner Herzog, right? Like, we just have to have idiosyncratic director shows up on our episode for a cameo part. Jim, let's talk about the whole Giorgio thing, right? Like the Giorgio schizophrenia plot line. You had some thoughts on this, Ari, the Trump voter.
I want to I want to talk about Joel Joe in a macro sense.
Okay, go ahead.
So let's be more out of this episode. Let's just talk about Joel Joe, Philippa Joel Joe as a construct.
Okay.
So these writers are sitting down. They're writing this show in 2016. Yeah. They come up with this idea of the Terran Empire. It's going to have the face of your mother. Well, what's the one thing that a lot of Americans are struggling with? It's mom and dad. I don't recognize my parents anymore. They're not the people who raised me. They become these sort of militant fascists, and I don't understand where it happened. And
3.5 hours of Fox News every night will do it to you.
Yeah, and the fact that we're not in 3.5 hours of Fox News every night, and we all, like, things that we took for granted about our parents, and I'm having this struggle. Yeah. I know you're having this struggle, Jason. I don't know about, you know, the UK system aid. I can't speak for you. But, like, one of the common frames among me and my contemporaries is I'm talking to these people that I love, but I don't understand what it is that they're saying or what they're about, because the ideals that they gave me and they instilled in me as an individual are no longer the ideas they're talking about. They're talking about the exact opposite of it. And Georgia personifies that. She is the Trump voter in 2016 who's going to vote again because they somehow became fascist. But we know, like, Bonham understands she's a not, quote unquote, the same Joel Joe, but they still have to deal with the emotional ramifications of this very familiar face, this very familiar person is inhabiting this role, and I want to relate to her like she's my mother, but I can't because I understand that something's fundamentally different.
Yeah.
And I think that's the metaphor of Joel Joe sort of unpacked. I also think that Joel Joe has something in, like, the series Bible says, never walks in the room and is in over her head. And I think that's still, like, why she can look at the face and be like, oh, there's no original Paul II.
Yeah.
Well, it's just like she just has macro knowledge to make her look cool.
We have these rules that seem to be attached to various elements of the show. Like Burnham is never wrong, or JoJo never loses her cool, or if those plot points are ever broken, it's a huge element of the story, right? Like, it's very intentional.
The thing about Georgia, though, is that annoys me more than anything else about it is that the characters seemingly have just completely forgotten that she was effectively Space Hitler, and she was responsible for the deaths of many, many people. She ate Saru's fat people on his planet for food.
That's right.
That's okay, though. We don't need to worry about that. Just ignore that. It's, you know, let's make jokes about a fat cat with her. Ho, 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 jiggle, jiggle, jiggle. It's like, the idea that she, like I said, the idea that she was the devil you knew in the other episodes where, like, we need this person. She's the only one going to get the job done because she's willing to take the risk because she don't give a crap.
Yeah.
That's gone now. Now she's just a member of the crew. Now they should be keeping her on a short leash, but they still just carry on joking with her. It's no problem at all. And it's like you don't forget what she's done in her old universe. She was responsible for killing lots and lots and lots and lots of people and enjoying it as well at the time.
Yeah.
So it's a bit annoying that.
Yeah, some of these shows, and I don't think Discovery is the sole guilty party here, but it's definitely visible where you have these characters who get on some kind of redemption arc. It's the Kylo Ren syndrome.
Right? It's exactly what I was going to say, yeah.
Where they do something terrible for like 95% of their career, but then at the very last minute they do one good thing and it's like, oh, okay, you're redeemed. Look, it doesn't work like that. Like, it's not that easy, man. Now, that being said, I would love to see an actual interesting long slog redemption plot line where a character like acknowledges the bad shit they did and voluntarily, like, takes responsibility for it. I mentioned this before in other shows, but it reminds me of the Thunderbolts, Kurt Busiek's old comic, The Thunderbolts. When the Beetle, who's now Mach 1 or Mach 2, I forget by this point, they all kind of get, like, their identities get revealed, and they're all have to, like, decide what they're going to do now because the whole, like, con game they've been playing is over. And Abe decides, well, I'm going to go to prison, of course, because I shot people. Like, I killed people and I have to go to jail. And his girlfriend, Songbird, is like, no, you don't, like, you could just tell them that wasn't you. Tell them you were mind controlled. He's like, well, that would be wrong. Right? Like, I don't want to, if I'm going to be a hero, I need to live up to the responsibilities that a hero brings. And And he goes to jail and he gets parole in a few years, you know, and he comes back to the show, but back to the comic. But he at least acknowledged that what he had did was wrong. And Giorgio, like you say, Abe, she's getting left off the hook for some pretty terrible, awful things, much worse than you know, the Beatle shooting somebody in the Spider-Man issue 30 years ago.
See, the show for that is not this show. The show for that is Deep Space Nine and the examination of Garak, the ex-CIA Cardassian operative.
Exactly.
Like, there's a character who acknowledges his sins, who is faced with the consequences, who at one point almost winds up committing suicide because he can't cope with the stressors of living the life that he's lived.
Yeah.
And fundamentally is changed, and he's given what he wants at the beginning of the show. Like, he wants to go home again. He goes home again, and his home is a sindled husk.
Yeah.
Because the Cardassians, his fellow people, couldn't see beyond their loyalty to the state.
I got you. So,
Garak is sort of like the fascist made good, I guess, is the narrative we're trying to tell with Giorgio. But Giorgio will hand wave things across, and will paint like we'll paint Lorca as a cartoon character for one episode, even though we haven't seen him as a cartoon character in the previous nine.
Yeah. Was Garrett the tailor?
Yeah.
Okay.
This,
go ahead, Ed.
I was going to say, this is also with Book, okay?
Yeah.
Book is a similar character, right? In the very first episode we are introduced to Book, he dupes Burnham into basically stepping into that thing so he can get away with his mission.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
He's lost all that now. He don't do anything like that. And he's now effectively a Starfleet officer without a uniform on, because he's like, oh, I'm going to be so caring. He'd be backstabbing every person he could get to if he was, you know, he's now got he's gone from chaotic neutral to neutral. You know, it's a weird thing. And I don't quite know if that might be the influence of Burnham over the course of the year. But even in the episode where we saw him come back on Discovery, where he's actually in uniform, he's still kind of begrudgingly doing stuff.
He's good.
But there's none of that kind of rogueness to him anymore. He literally just kind of is by the book. Ha ha. Double pun. So it's weird.
So let's talk about some of the subplots in this episode. The number one one being the whole Stamets Adira plotline. Adira is accompanied by the spirit of her previous host, and Stamets, and she bond over it because Stamets also saw like visions of his boyfriend before he came back. Stamets and Adira are now bonding. Jim, what do you think?
I again, like when the show is about characters,
yes,
about characters interacting with each other and trying to figure out who they are as people and who they are interacting with other people, Discovery is top notch. Discovery is exactly what I want it to be.
Yeah.
And this was more of that. And this was Stamets sitting there, and like that, you see that slow recognition in Anthony Rapp's eyes as he's listening. Like, that's like one of the hardest things to do. As an actor, is to listen, or to be actively engaged in listening. Because you've read the script, you know the line, you can't really be surprised by it, but you're still like trying to emote. And there's that slow realization of, oh, you're me when I was 16.
Yeah.
Like, that's why I can't relate to Tilly, because naturally that should have been my role in like maybe season one. Like, this was another Star Trek. This was another type of show that would have been like the built-in sort of dynamic, and that was what was missing. And he's sort of like recognizing that, but he can't quite commit to it until he's in bed with, I almost said Wilson Cruz, but Dr. Colville. And Colville's the one who emotionally is supportive enough to him to give him that gentle push that he needs to accept, I want to help this person.
Yeah, I want to help this person.
Because no one was there to help me. And I think it was very well done. I liked all of it. I liked the fact that he was just curious, like someone's talking to themselves. that's strange. But I live in the future, the fall future of my already future state.
Yeah.
And you know, I've experienced so much. So why am I going to invalidate whole experience because it doesn't coincide with what I have accepted about the rules of reality?
The, the plot is weak, but the character interactions are strong. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Aid, you agree with that?
Yeah. Again, the idea that Adira basically just decides to take some of the spore stuff apart on the offshoot, and weren't we on hold to go and jump to Andorian space or whatever? And it's like you're just taking it apart. That's weird. The other thing is, I'm not too sure. She's effectively, again, she's not technically a Starfleet officer, but she is a Starfleet officer because she holds the memories of the Admiral that she previously there. So they've not acknowledged the fact that she's kind of like still retains any rank from her previous host. She's still there as just like a hanger on. And again, the idea that Starfleet would just say, oh, just let that person take your ship apart, that's fine, is really weird. But the other thing, again, is this is purely on a aesthetics thing. I would really like her to have a different colour suit than the blue, because it almost looks like a uniform they forgot to put the gold on.
Oh yeah,
I know it's just ridiculous, but just something, just another colour, or even shockingly, like, what about an idea of they have a different something, wear something different every episode? But it would just be there's nothing to make them stand out, and it's just weird. But the actual character themselves, good. I like the idea. How Stamets knows about the Trill again. Next Generation, Beverly Crusher, first to discover the symbiotes. You do not know about the Trill. Sorry, you don't know. But apparently you now can just reel off facts like you just read an encyclopedia yesterday with all your true knowledge in it. but yeah, I quite like the idea that they're saying on it. But like you said, the idea that dynamic should have been Stamets and Tilly in season one is now this character. But the idea that he was also treating her as a 16-year-old, where she's got like a 900-year-old symbiote in that's also getting information, seems to be a bit kind of like, oh, you're just laughing with tweens. It's like, she's got the memories of her 900 years. She's got more memories than all the crew put together, with all of that technology between your time period and this time period. You should bloody listen to her, for Christ's sake, you know?
So at the end of this episode, Burnham gets relieved of her first officer duties. A slap on the wrist.
Okay, wait a minute. Whoa. Before that.
Yeah.
Before that. Before we get to the end of it, can we just talk about the escape?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so the escape, right. First of all, those new weapons they've got on there that were disintegrating people in the pre-first episode now seem to just shoot people and to knock them down because they need to be saved and walked away later on. Secondly, unless I'm mistaken again, I believe there used to be a thing in the Geneva Convention that would stop people using certain weapons against personnel, and there was some kind of weird glitch in it, but they said uniforms were cast as equipment, so you could use it against the uniforms but not against the people, and they just happened to be casual. The idea that Giorgio and Burnham are happily shooting characters with weapons from starships, that seems a little bit over the top. It's they literally go up in clouds of smoke. It's just like, what are you doing? You're just idea that we're trying to deal with, the very first episode, very first part of the episode is like, oh, we're trying to do negotiations with the Orions. Now you just sent someone there that's literally just blown up the plant, killed a load of people. That's not going to help your case. So the idea you could have done it a little bit more tactfully and stealthily than that. You can understand Giorgio doing it, but Burnham was there as well firing. You know, it just seems to be like, what are you doing?
Jim?
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with Aid's perspective. It reminds me of Batman Begins.
Okay.
Specifically, like, the whole movie is like Batman won't kill. Like, that's the reason why he has a falling out with Ra's al Ghul at the beginning of the film.
Right.
And that's what visits him at the end. And then his line is, you know, I'm not going to kill you, but I don't have to save you. So I'm going to leave you to this awful death. And it's so obvious that he's going to die. Like, Batman essentially kills this guy. But it's that narrative conceit that he doesn't do it.
Yeah.
And I think Burnham is using Giorgio as the Like, I'm not technically hitting the firing button, but I'm going to pilot the ship. So I'm technically not doing the explosion to people, but I'll let you clean up the mess.
I laughed when they pulled out the, hey, remember that thing that we did in that place that time? Again.
I did seven. I put a mental pin though. I'm like, okay, here's another one.
Yeah.
So then they get back and the Admiral has a couple of things to say. The first thing he says is actually to Saru, and he was like, actually, I might have let her go. And Saru kind of gets a little reprimanded himself in that scene. But I did agree with one thing the Admiral said. He said, the only reason why you're not in the brig is because you saved people's lives. And I believed it. Like, that felt legit to me. Like, okay, yes. She broke away. She did something bad. She disobeyed a direct order. But in Star Trek, in Starfleet, I disobeyed a direct order, but I saved lives is a legit defense. Isn't it?
Yeah, that's the Culp defense. That's the whole reason why, you know, we're not throwing Culp into the brig at the end of Star Trek 4. He saves all of all.
He saves lives, right, exactly.
Yeah, but how many Orions and Andorians were killed to save those lives?
Yeah.
It's not like a rescue mission. And again, the idea, if that was technically classed as a prison to the, that actually belonged to the Andorians and not just kind of like a slave labor camp, theoretically as a prison, and I'm assuming Book, I don't even know why Book was actually put in there. I'm assuming it's to do with his previous naughtiness with the actual thing, the people at the beginning. They basically caught up with him and said, right, you're going there. Now that's a legitimate government, theoretically, and they've just basically blundered in there, killed a load of their people and bogged off. And you're thinking, what? That's not going to have some kind of, you know, telling off. It just seems to be a little bit. They let her go a little bit. I just think, you know, I don't know.
Jim?
My problem with the scene is no one actually tells her off.
True.
The Admiral doesn't dress her down.
Right.
The Admiral allows Bonham to dress herself down.
Right.
All the agency in the scene is still Bonham.
It is.
Bonham's still in control. She's not actually being read the riot act. She's not punished. Yes, she's whole job is taken away, but it's again, it goes back to the Culp defense. She's being given the job that she wants, which is, wow, I need to be in charge of the science division in order to figure out what's wrong with the Bond. I don't need the bureaucratic. I don't need to be going off on away missions to save plants. I need to be focused on what caused the Bond, and she can best do that in the science lab.
I think she's going to quit Starfleet.
But where do you go? Where do you go with that? Yeah, what do you do with the show then? Where do you run a Burnham episode and a Discovery episode every other week? Or yeah, you can't really do it as such as that. You know, it wouldn't surprise me. But there you go. But the other weird thing being as well is the oh, I forgot what I was gonna say now. Got completely out of my head. Completely out of my head.
Go ahead. I was thinking about Saru a lot this week, and somebody pointed out to me that Saru is the only straight white dude on this show. Right? He's the only straight white dude on this show. But he's the alien. So, and it's an interesting flip of the usual dynamics where it's always the LGBTQ characters that end up being aliens. Right, like,
we're still dealing with that with the trail subplot we're still dealing with that those tropes.
But he's surrounded by black characters and women and non-binary characters and all kinds of other, you know. So he's the only straight white dude on the ship, but that makes him the alien. And I found it kind of interesting because I've been on that team. I was on a team where I was the only straight white dude on the team, and I felt kind of like the alien. And what was interesting about it was that they were just as reassuring, constantly reassuring to me, as the crew is constantly reassuring to Saru. They're always like, including even when Burnham loses her rank, she's like, Saru, you did the right thing. And everyone is constantly, it seems like their secondary job is reassuring the captain that he's doing the right thing. And it's it's funny to me, and yet I found it very, I recognized it. Like, I actually kind of identified with Saru as the one that other people are like, you know, it's okay, you're doing all right. Like, I know you feel like you're the weird one out, but actually you're doing okay. And yeah, go ahead, Abe.
So the thing about that is, the only problem with that is can you see Kirk being in that position? Now, what was the one time we've seen Kirk be in that position? Decker from the motion picture.
Oh, right.
He constantly was going, oh, Jim, don't do it that way. The idea that you've got your crew constantly saying, oh, good job, oh, no, that's not good. That, if you're captain, your decision's final, mate. That's it. And the idea that you're always constantly second-guessing everything he does, it would get, is going to get annoying, and it's going to get annoying in context of the show, because it's basically going to get, what's the point of having a captain? You might as well just have a little council meeting and get together to make decisions, because there's nothing going on if you haven't got a captain.
I found it appropriate that he relieved her of her first officer duties. I think he felt like he had to. It creates an obvious gap in the command structure of the ship now. But Jim, there's, like, everybody uses the admiral uses the phrase number one. Like, everybody knows what number one means. I thought it was a fairly unusual phrase. I thought that Picard referred to Riker as his number one. I didn't think that was normal. I mean, Kirk never does it. So
it doesn't. Janeway doesn't.
Yeah. So why? What's the deal with number one?
So let's unpack that. Let's go on the history, kids.
Yeah,
I made notes because I have a theory.
Okay, you have a theory.
I know I opened the episode with I'm not going to have theories, but I do have a pretty good theory. So you know, that lasted 55 minutes. So we all introduced to Major Barrett's character in the cage. Originally, Major Barrett was going to be the number one to Captain Robert April when Gene Roddenberry was forced doing his notes.
Okay.
And there was a lot of sexism in number one sort of description. Like, she's cool, like a fridge. And I think they use that line in Where No Man Has Gone Before. We'll never explain what the number one means. Like, it's clear that she's second in command. But then Dorothy Fontana of Journey to Babel fame wrote a Star Trek novel. It's the only Star Trek novel she wrote, which is Vulcan's Glory. It's a really good one. Like, if you want a solid TOS novel, it's more pick up. And she says, oh, number one means that that's sort of her name in this alien race of aliens that we wind up meeting in Enterprise. And the reason why she's called number one is she's the best intellect of whole generation. She's the number one brain.
She's the Hermione of Star Trek.
Yeah. So, you know, she's like the best student in school. So you got the number one title. And now everyone pulls to you because all names are so complicated that regular people can't pronounce them. And Dorothy's cribbing herself because she gave Spock a false name, but we never met that. We never hold that false name because it was impossible for humans to pronounce it. So she's sort of cribbing from her notes here. Now, Picard uses it.
Yeah.
Picard uses it for Michael, because what did Gene Roddenberry do when he got Next Generation? Well, he went back to his Pike notes and he started taking his old ideas of Star Trek and updating them for the 1980s.
Yeah.
Like, by that point, Kirk and Bones were in the care of Hal Bennett and Nicholas Meyer with the films. He didn't want to repeat himself in that direction, but he's like, I have this whole other Star Trek in my head that's Horatio Hornblower in space.
Yeah.
I'm going to do that. So I'm going to take all these notes and transpose them, and I'll have David Jill type up a series Bible, but we'll give him a payout so he doesn't sue us. And we'll just say it's created by Gene Roddenberry, right? And that's not sort of how that shakes up. No other captain uses it. So it's kind of like this weird sort of like acknowledgement to the past, like maybe, you know, Picard's shown as this lover of architects, of artifacts. Maybe he picked this up as a phrase, and he just applied it to his second in command. Now, by the time we get to Discovery, number one is like standard operating procedure.
It does, yeah, it appears to be.
Yeah, like Georgiou uses that specifically to Bornham.
Oh,
And it's to denote that Bonham has a higher station than Saru does. And in they make more hay of this in one of the very first Discovery novel. It's because the number one position's open and both of them are vying for the role.
Oh, I see.
And so it's them sort of competing and one-upping each other. And Bonham just happens to, because Bonham's always right, happens to beat out Saru with the help of Spock.
Okay.
Because, you know, it's a Star Trek novel. And Star Trek novels, like, jam a whole bunch of stuff in there and put it in a blender. Now, my thinking is that the number one position is not necessarily tied to the ranking of the officer, but could just be the person I rely on. And I think that's going to be Tilly. So the original ranking of number one in the Pike era, in the Cage, in the Robert April notes, she was only a lieutenant because Roddenberry based the ranking system on Napoleonic naval rankings. Yep. They don't have commanders.
They don't.
In fact, there was a Deep Space Nine episode that references any person of any rank is called a captain if he's in charge of the ship.
That's right.
That's a clear naval tradition from these Napoleonic novels.
For sure.
So you can have a lieutenant commander who is captain, like Captain Data in the Redemption storyline.
Yep. Yep.
He doesn't go up in rank, but he has the title because he's in command of the ship.
Yeah.
Well, I think she's probably going to be promoted to lieutenant, and she's going to be given like second in command duties. Because it's the person that Saru is always confiding in.
Well, that's true. We saw that from the second episode.
We saw that in the second episode. We saw that in the last week when she had the dental. He had the dental.
Yep.
The Trill episode and the family dental explodes and Tilly reaches out to him. And in this episode, it's the callback to that. Saru reaches out to Tilly. And what's the one thing that we know about Tilly? One day, she is going to be a captain, and the show has told us she is going to be the best captain in all of Starfleet. And this moves her along without having to go through all the ranks of ensign, Lieutenant JG, Lieutenant, Lieutenant Commander, like all of that TNG codified stuff just sort of get pushed by the wayside. And we don't have to worry about it.
First Officer Tilly, Abe, what do you think?
Yeah, that makes sense. I wouldn't have thought about it. I was convinced it was going to be the returning actress from the Cyborg Lady.
Nelson?
Because she's there. She sits on the big comfy chair when they're all off. So the idea that it would be her would be nice because she gets some words to say rather than just nodding and wandering off. So that would be cool, but yeah, Tilly does make sense in that respect. I suppose it does kind of make an idea of. Yeah, but then you take her out of science, and then again, you've got Adira and Stamets to be that kind of fill that part in. So,
and the other piece of evidence that's not tied to this is by the time you get the TOS movie timeline, everyone's a captain. Scotty's a captain of engineering.
Exactly.
Bones is a captain of the medical sick bay. Like. Everyone at that point is a captain, like Spock's a captain and Kirk's a captain. And so now you can have captains of divisions. So Bonham can be higher in rank in the chain of command that Discovery does not care about. But she could be the commando of the science labs.
Yeah.
But Tilly now can be your lieutenant, you know, the lieutenant first grade in charge of bureaucratic running the starship.
It seemed to me that they just have too many characters in the engineering room. Like you've got Stamets, of course, and Tilly, but now you've also got who's the woman that we asked last season?
Yeah.
And Adira now. So there's just too many people in that room, and for a writer's room, like okay, we got to get somebody out of there. The set's too crowded, so we don't have enough time to give everybody the time that they need in that set. So if we move Tilly to the command track, effectively, she becomes first officer. She can still help out once in a while with the tech stuff, but it's not her primary duty anymore.
If that means we start getting to know the bridge crew, we start getting to know Reese and Bryce and Owo and Detmo and Lieutenant Nielsen, because one of the main characters is now focused on being on the bridge.
Right.
I'll fold that because I want to know more about these guys who are just background fodder at this point.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. And also, you can see a lot of the relationships between the characters being redesigned by the writing team. Like, okay, we used to have a lot of Stamets-Tilly interaction, but now Adira's going to fulfill that role. So where is Tilly's main point of contact going to be? It makes total sense for it to be Stuart. I've been a Tilly fan. I've been standing Ensign Tilly since the first episode. She's always been my favorite character. I wrote to that actress, and she did not reply to me, unlike some people on the show, who obviously have more cred than I. But I would love to see that happen. I hope that you're right. But we will find out next week when we finally get to this is an episode we've been looking forward to for a long time because this is the part three. I got the name.
Unification.
Right. Say again.
Unification part three.
Unification. It's not part three, as you noted in the very beginning. It's just unification three. And it appears it's Roman numeral three, so it looks like a planet. It looks like Nimbus 3 or some another planet like that, rather than a part three of an episode. Although, of course, it's a callback to the famous Spock Next Generation crossover, which I will always remember because it's when Data learns how to nerve pinch. But anyway.
We've always seen some images, haven't we, from that?
Yeah, we have, and they look like Romulans or Vulcans to me.
Romulan Vulcan, yeah, which would kind of make sense.
Yeah, for sure. It's been 1,000 years.
Someone got a screen grab of one of the costume pieces and the little badge that they're having that, you know, you could probably buy next you know, season.
Yeah.
They cross between the Itik logo and the Romulan Bird of Prey logo.
No shit.
Yeah, it's in the outline of it, but it's in the colors and the pigmentation of the edict. So I think those are some sort of like maybe Vulcans and Romulans post Picard got their shit together and created an awful society that we now have to go fix.
Now, the interesting thing about this is we've obviously got a lot of Romulan stuff going on in Picard.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the first time we're actually going to see Romulans in the Discovery. Are we going to acknowledge anything now with the Kelvinverse stuff? Now we actually own the rights to the Kelvinverse stuff.
Now it's all
amalgamated into one thing. Are we actually going to acknowledge the fact that Romulus was nuked and went a bit haywire in that movie?
Yeah, yeah. Are they going to acknowledge what happened? It'll be very interesting. Of course, because Elnor is my favorite character in Star Trek now, I want to see one of the characters. I want to see a reference. I want to see a name drop of the monastic order of fighting of warrior nuns that Elnor was a member of, so that this show acknowledges what's happened in Picard. I want to hear them say something that says, yes, this is in the same universe as Picard is set, even though it should be, but is it? Like, it's all been...
This episode is the only episode that they actually have the opportunity to do that. And it's being written by Christian Bale, who is the Star Trek novelist who took over the post-Voyager relaunch books and just cleared out she just wrote the last one that cleared out the old continuity in favor of the new books that are coming out now.
Okay.
And she also wrote the Pavan episode in season one, the episode where Saru has his... He wants to live on that planet, and he steals everyone's, like, it's a great episode. It's a great episode in season one that I was like, ooh, this is really good. I really like this.
Interesting.
So I have a lot of faith in terms of like the writing of this coming episode.
Well, join us again next week where we see if Jim's vow to not review individual episode, how long that lasts. In the meantime, we'll see you then. Thanks, everyone.